It's real rural development. And the corn people will benefit because we'll make it out of Cobbs and Stover. As you can see, I have been well fed over the years. And the best cook who ever lived was Grandma Flinchbaugh in Pennsylvania Dutch country in York County. She fired that old cook stove every winter with corn cobs. She evidently knew something that we have forgotten. That was before the Arabs and their oil. So I would argue that the current situation is temporary. I would not for a moment downplay how difficult it is for the livestock industry, although it's less difficult for you than it is for hogs and chickens because of DDGs. It's temporary. It's not permanent. And that we can do food, feed, fiber, and fuel, and all prosper. And I would hope that you view this thing as temporary and don't come out of here unglued. Because if you do, it'll backfire. You see, there's five reasons why. Renewable energy makes sense. First and foremost is national security. I had a discussion about 6 months ago with former CIA Director Woolsey. It's a dinner meeting, actually. And the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, was there. And I love to get in a discussion with Newt. He's brilliant. If we could get 80% of Newt without the other 20, by God, we'd be in business. But it's that other 20 that gets him in trouble. But here's what CIA Director Woolsey said, and it's so blatant and so obvious. And I was angry because I hadn't thought of it. This is the first war in history in which both sides are being funded by one side. We buy their oil, and they educate the next class of terrorists. I looked that up in Webster, and it was under the word stupidity. So as you debate the ethanol question, keep in mind national security. Number two, in the long haul, it will increase farm income. In fact, we had a study done, 25 by 25, had a study done at the University of Tennessee. So it had to be right. Anybody here from Tennessee? Yeah, so it had to be right, right? Now, I always was skeptical of these econometric studies that go out 25 years. They make some heroic assumptions. But that study showed, and it was well done, that actually the income, the net income in the beef industry, if we reach the goal of 25 by 25, would increase about 3.5%. Hogs were negative, and so were chickens. Third, it will decrease energy costs in the long run. Fourth, it is rural development with local jobs. And five, it is environmentally friendly. So the train has left the station. And we all, depending on which commodity we produce, what business we're in, are going to have to figure out how to prosper under it. Well, this is a analysis, quick and dirty, of what this farm bill debate will be all about. We didn't touch COOL. We didn't touch packer ownership. If you'd like to talk about that in the discussion, we will. Let me end this way, and then we'll open it to questions. As an individual who's been an educator in the policy arena, the ag policy arena, for 36 years now, I always plead for let's debate on the facts. Let's base the decision on the facts, rather than emotion. If we do, we'll get more workable policy. Now, that's hard to kind of put your finger on, but I came across a way of doing this. Now, everybody in here is going to be brutally honest with me, especially those people from Kansas that I know well. How many in here been to Hooters? Hooters. Come on, put your hands up. You and I were there together. Now, be very careful how you answer this question. Now, Liz, you'll be all right. But be very careful. Did you notice the busboy? So help me, this happened. I used this at another meeting, and this is a perfect story to tell when the Cowboys are in town. Some young man popped up and said, "I don't go to Hooters, I'm a vegetarian." I said, "Who goes to Hooters for the hamburger?" But now, can you run Hooters without the busboy? Would it work? No. He's absolutely essential. And that's just like facts in the policy world. You will get better policy if you learn the facts before you make a decision. So, when you're working on this, think about the busboy. And forget about the emotion attached to the Hooters. And you'll understand. Who has the first question? I'm being paid to 3:15, so I'm going to stay here that long. Yes, sir. Well, the question is, talk about the national economy in China and Japan. Now, I said I would be here till 3:15. The national economy. If you remember, Bill Clinton beat Papa Bush on the slogan, "It's the economy, stupid." Remember that? Well, if that had been the slogan in November of 06, the Congress would still be Republican. The national economy, year by year, in the last decade, has been remarkable. I mean, you don't get better statistics. You know, we grow 3.5% a year. Unemployment's under 5%. Interest rates, the prime's now, what, 8? Stock market will hit 12,000, I think. It's hovering around 11.5. The housing market has cooled, which was absolutely necessary to keep the economy steady as you go. So I don't know what I'd change. And it's not true the jobs are leaving. It's not true that the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer. Now, is the wealth distributed as well as I would like? No. There are people wealthier than I am. That puts that in perspective. So I think the national economy is, I'd give it at least an A-. And I would give this president a good grade on the economy. He has other problems, however. China and India. Energy demand increasing 30% a year. Economy's growing 11% in China 2 years ago. So the same story is basically here around the world. Real incomes are increasing. And nothing is more important to the cattle industry than improving real incomes. Everybody that gets wealthier somehow wants to go, you know, you go from cereal to hamburger to steak. That happens everywhere in the world, with the exception of some areas where you don't eat beef. So it's a good story, I would argue. And the most remarkable statistic, and some people don't believe me on this, so they go look it up. The American economy grew every quarter since 9/11. The worst shock to the American economy since Pearl Harbor. And we grew every quarter since 9/11. That tells me we're doing something right. Next question. Yes, sir.
Just for cowboy arithmetic.
Is that the same as KU math?
Your choice.
Okay.
How big? I know when my deficit gets so big, my banker gets upset.
Mm-hmm.
By the same tone, how big is this deficit get owned by foreigners to where there should be some concern?
Now, you all hear the question? How big can this deficit get? How big does it have to get before we're concerned? And especially that the debt is being bought up by foreigners. You know, there's an old saying that if you have two economists in one room, you have a minimum of three opinions. That kind of fits this question. But I'll answer it. It is true that this is current consumption, not paid for. It's another case of Grandpa and Grandma ripping off the grandkids. But the reason your banker is upset, if your debt-to-asset ratio gets out of line, is that you don't have taxing authority. If you did, he'd be less apt to get upset, wouldn't he? So you can't make the comparison. It sounds logical, and it's a good question, but you're dealing with apples and oranges. I've always argued if we can keep the deficit under 5% of gross domestic product, we can handle it. And when we look at the national debt, now that's not the deficit, that's the national debt. The deficit is the yearly contribution. How big can it get? Well, in the commercial world, you know, if that debt-to-asset ratio gets above 40%, we get concerned. We'd really like to see it at 20. Some conservative bankers like 10. They don't really want to loan money. So where is it on the balance sheet of the United States? Do we know? No. How much is Mount Rushmore worth? How much is the Statue of Liberty worth? How much is Rocky Mountain National Park worth? You see, again, you can't quite get that comparison. I think the effective measure is that when times are exceptionally good, you should bring it down. And irony of all irony in some people's mind, Bill Clinton did that. The last 3 years, I don't know, it might be on here. Yeah. See that surplus? Above the line? That's Clinton years. If you and I didn't know better, we would assume he was living right, you see. But those were good years. The economy was perking faster than it is now, and we paid down debt. As long as you do that, I think it's workable. And you keep it under 5%. Next question. Yes. The question is, if crude gets cheaper, will that slow down the development of ethanol? Well, economics would say yes. Current psychology probably says no, you know. I mean, this is a nation of entrepreneurs. We will overbuild. If we don't, it'll be the first product in history in which we didn't. Now, are we there? I don't know. If I was building a new plant today, I would make sure that it could convert to cellulose. And I certainly, if I was building an ethanol plant, I'd want to build it next to a feed yard. So you don't have to dry it and haul it. But yes, clearly the price of crude is related to the well-being of ethanol. And as we were going into this 25 by 25 debate, some of them, the steering committee, the group we pulled together the first time, said, you know, if we're successful, the Saudis will pull the plug. Well, I don't buy that. And I think I've done my homework. I can't find an estimate anywhere that says that at current consumption, the Saudis have more than a 65-year supply. That's a current consumption. Now add India growing 30% and China growing 30%. And that kingdom over there They know when they run out of oil, that'll be the end of the kingdom. And the old prince evidently worries about his grandkids. I don't think they'll do it, because it's not in their long-run best interest. It's in their long-run best interest to draw that out as far as possible. So that decreases the relationship between crude and ethanol. And if you look at what OPEC's done in the last 12 months, you kind of sense that. You know, they can announce tomorrow morning that they're going to turn on the spigot and drive it to $40. They have the ability to do that. And once you get below 35, the ethanol industry's in trouble. So I don't think that'll happen. I do think we have to understand that there is enough of demand for energy around the world, and it's increasing about 7% a year if you throw all the world together. That's kind of a meaningless number. And so the chances of the supply outstripping the demand are fairly slim. And so we have to look at all sources. Oil domestically, biofuels, wind, solar, hydro, nuclear. Next question. Yes?
Do you think there will be any increased value of thorn bushes and persimmon sprouts if we use chips?
Now, I've got a Pennsylvania Dutch accent, and you've got a Southern accent, and I didn't catch it.
We have a lot of thorn bushes down.
Thorn bushes, yes.
And persimmon sprouts.
Persimmon sprouts?
Yeah. I'm just wondering if I'm going to be able to sell
them. He wants to know if we can make ethanol out of thorn bushes and persimmon trees.
If you'll do that, we'll make a lot of money, sir.
Well, they have cellulose in them, don't they? Yeah. So it's doable. Now, how competitive, I can't answer that, but it is chemically doable. Yes?
What is the byproduct of the cellulose ethanol and catalytic
UBS? What is the byproduct of the cellulosic process, and can the cattle, can you feed it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Somebody in here know that's got a chemical background? It's the same as feeding sawdust.
I said you can feed them sawdust.
Yeah, you got to put a little sugar, make it sweet. So it is doable, but it's not going to be competitive with DDGs. It depends whether you are finishing them, I guess, or just keeping them alive. So. Next question. Both, did you say? Yeah, next question. Yes, sir.
Could you talk a little bit about the trade deficit, whether that's really a concern?
The trade deficit? Well, there's a lot of things that go into the trade deficit. And first and foremost is the value of the dollar. Second is regulatory provisions. And the value of the dollar, of course, can act like a subsidy or a tax. And it is heavily influenced by what the Fed does. I am concerned to a degree about... Oh, there's a chart I forgot. We'll digress for a few minutes, now I'll get back. But this chart fits what you're asking about, trade deficit. This is producer subsidy equivalents. And that influences our ability to trade. You know, my Australian friends and my Canadian friends always say we ought to increase the loan rate in the United States. Especially when we had that old non-recourse loan, which put a floor under prices. And the higher our loan rate, the higher the price floor. And then our grain went into government storage and they sold theirs. So they like us to do more of this, depending on how we do it. Well, this shows how much each country is subsidizing its farmers. And that does affect the trade deficit. And, of course, we're at 21. The European Union's at 32. They spend twice as much on farm programs as we do. Japan's never seen a subsidy they don't like. And the USA's at 16. The question on how big can this trade deficit get before it's a problem is very difficult to answer, sir. It's not there yet. Will it go there? Will it go there? I doubt it. Because the value of the dollar does react to these things. And we get an increase in the value of the dollar, our exports will go down and our imports will go up. But the reversal, we get a decrease in the value of the dollar, and that makes imports more expensive and exports cheaper. So this thing has a way of self-correcting. So I don't think it's a problem at the moment. And that's in current dollars, remember. That's why it looks so steep. So, it is something that you pay attention to, you watch, but you lose no sleep over. That's the best I can do. Next question. Yes. Would you want a fossil fuels partner this day and age? Pardon? Yeah. Well, I think what you're getting at is this a flash in the pan or is it really permanent?
Well, what I'm getting at is to me the fossil fuel industry is going to squelch anything that is done from coal or any other.
Okay, what you're saying is then, or what the question is will the fossil fuel industry, let's be straight, big oil, will they finally kill this? And you know, you all are going to think that this old man up here is an eternal optimist, but I am. No. Would they if they could? That's a judgmental question. I think we all know the answer. No, they're not slowing it down now. Let's compare it to the tobacco companies. Let's compare big oil with big tobacco. Now, what did big tobacco do? When the United States government had a quota system in place that was costing us $100 million a year. At the same time, another cabinet agency required that you print on the label, if you use these damn things, they'll kill you. A slight bit of inconsistency there. But politics is not consistent or logical. Remember. So then finally, after some fighting and lying to the Congress as some would say. Big Tobacco got the message. Philip Morris today gets less than 10% of its gross sales from tobacco. My prediction is it's going to take a longer period of time, but that's the same thing that will happen with big oil. What does BP stand for? British Petroleum? No! Beyond Petroleum. Read their advertisements. Shell Oil Company. They're spending millions on renewable fuel research. They're getting the message. And you know, the cynics will laugh.
Is it not true that big oil is investing a lot of money?
That's right. That's my point. They are starting to invest. So is Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Goldman Sachs. I always pay attention to what Warren Buffett does. Why? Just look at his bottom line. He's made few mistakes. And, you know, again, as I said a second ago, the cynics don't buy this, but this country has decided. Both sides of the aisle, left and right, that we are going to work towards energy independence from the Middle East. And there's a piece of the action for domestic oil, biofuels, wind, solar, hydro, nuclear. I think that's here. And the only thing that's holding it is technology. And do any of you recall an industry in history where we've thrown more money at research and development than we're throwing at renewable fuels right now? I don't. Next question. That's a very good question. I mean, that's where the battle is. Yes, sir. Cool?
Cool, they keep on the contract. So all the grass and everything is not getting there.
Are you saying coal or cool?
Cool.
C-O-A-L.
Cool.
Country of origin labeling. Well, we're getting towards the end. I am worried that we're going to be stupid enough to try it. How's that for being blunt? If coal will work, the marketplace will create it. If it pays to label on country of origin, entrepreneurs will do it. The reason they're not doing it is it won't work, and so then the government will try it. You poll consumers and they'll say, yes, I will buy American beef. All you need to do is label it. There's even one study out that says we'll pay 11% more for it. Now, there's a cowboy term that fits that. Bullshit. The average consumer has to pay attention to price. And yeah, she'll tell the guy that calls her on the phone, I'm a patriot and I'll buy American first. And I'll pay more for it. Then watch what she does in the supermarket. You see, the commercial world is not labeling because they know it doesn't pay. Now, I'll tell you something else for those of you that support it. If I thought it had an ounce of working, I would say, let's do it. If it'll get you more of a piece of the action and increase your bottom line, do it. But find me the evidence that says that'll happen. It's not there. And, you know, we did it very much undercover in the Farm Bill. It doesn't belong there. Then after we did it, well, my God, what did we do? So we quickly postponed it, except for fish. And, you know, at this convention, I don't think that bothers anybody. And why did we do it for fish and not beef? I use this every semester in my ag policy course to teach those kids where little babies come from in the policy world. We did it for fish because at the time the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee was from Alaska. And the incoming chair was from Mississippi. Vietnamese catfish. Got a good friend in Mississippi, Bruce Brumfield, raised catfish. You don't like those Vietnamese catfish. Don't taste as good. You see. But, you know, it's a great idea if it would work, but I don't see any evidence that it would work. 5 more minutes. Next question. Yes. Illegal immigration affect the farm bill? I hope we don't tie that into the farm bill. We got enough in there now. And you might not have been here when I said what the solution was. At least you weren't up front, were you? Yeah, well, they're pushing for mandatory animal ID. Yeah, we're going to do that so we give every immigrant a cow and we solve both problems. You see. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Actually, it does, you know, if you think about it. I'm no authority on immigration. That doesn't stop me from telling you what I think, but, you know, if you look at the facts instead of the emotion, how are we going to keep this economy going if we ship 12 million of them home? How are we going to get breakfast? How are we going to get the bed made? We're lazy. We don't want to do that crap anymore. You know? And how do you ship 12 million home? You know, I will not talk about the Iraqi war. That's one thing I won't talk about. But let me put it this way. I think George Bush is absolutely correct on immigration. I think his plan will work. It's not based on emotion. It's based on the real world. Facts. And ironically, this Congress will give it to him when the last one wouldn't. So we make strange bedfellows in the political world. One more, then we're going to quit.